people that you, chemists that you associated with in the 30s before World War II, and we're at Chicago, and we just were getting to mention the name Harkins, who was with Karash up there, and you mentioned something about that he claimed that he discovered something that
Harkins was a. Well, I don't know. This is important, but here I was arguing about he had priority on new ideas that other people published.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because apparently Karash was sort of a difficult fellow as well, from what
he was pretty, what do you call it, spiggity.
Right, because apparently Marvel and Karash weren't on great terms.
Yeah. Well, let's see, well, at Ann Arbor, I didn't know the chemist as well as I knew the physicist. There was an electrochemist at Ann Arbor, Ferguson, that I knew quite well. He was active in the Electrochem Society when I was. And then Elder went there, but that was later. You know him, do you not?
Elder, E-L-D-E-R? Elder?
Yeah.
I don't.
Well, he had been at Columbia, I think, and went from Columbia to Ann Arbor.
No, I didn't. I've never heard of him before. But that doesn't, I mean.
I may not have the name quite right, but I'm.
E-L-D-E-R, Elder.
E-L-D-E-R, I would guess. Oh, okay.
Was there anyone of these people or others we haven't mentioned who was particularly important to you?
Yes.
I mean, in terms of you.
I haven't mentioned the people. Other great friends that became a great friend of mine was Jack Kirkwood.
Kirkwood?
Jack Kirkwood, one of our great theoretical chemists. Mm-hmm. He was very interested in these solution things.
Mm-hmm.
He was very interested. Some of my work was interested in the properties of solutions of the amino acids or the and I used glycine in order to increase dielectric constant, and I got acquainted with Edwin Korn, who was head of the physical chem laboratory in Harvard Medical School.
Mm-hmm.
He was very interested in these solution properties. George Scatcherd over at MIT.
Scatcherd?
George Scatcherd, S-C-A-T-C-H-A-R-D.
Mm-hmm.
George Scatcherd. See, Kirkwood was at MIT with Scatcherd before he went to Cornell. Then he went from Cornell to Caltech and from Caltech back to Yale.
Wow,
he died much too young at Yale. He was getting it. Had some very interesting problems about theory of nerve action in his later years. You get a source of potential at the boundary between a boundary between different dielectric constants.
Mm-hmm.
And this was part of his theory of the potential for nerve action, I know.
Huh.
George Scatcherd was probably the most influential of all these people. I'll tell you a story about why, but now let's see who else. I knew Shedlovsky at Rockefeller Institute at that time. He was a friend of mine, interested in these solution problems. And
Kistakowski?
I knew Kisty. Very well during the war years, of course. I could tell you interesting stories about his fights with his first wife and his picking at his second wife at Los Alamos.
that's a story under itself, I think.
Let's see who else. I knew Onsager at Yale.
Oh yes.
And Fuas. I've seen Fuas since he's retired.
How do you spell that name?
Fuas. Fuas. F-U-O-S-S. Fuas was at Brown with Charlie Krause.
Oh yes.
Was another old friend of mine. and he went from Brown to Yale. Fuas did. He's retired now. Let's see, at Harvard, the physical organic chemist.
Bartlett?
Huh?
Not Bartlett.
Bartlett, yeah, okay. Paul Bartlett.
Paul Bartlett?
Yeah. I knew Kiske, of course. I knew slightly Bright Wilson. I didn't know him well, like his other people.
And you carried on correspondence with some of these people? And
I saw, a great deal, and I saw them at, I saw them, most all of them, at Academy meetings as well as at ACS meetings.
Why was this, why was George Scatcherd such a an influential?
Well, I'll tell you, Columbia, of course, the people I knew were Lemaire. I knew Vic Lemaire very well. Yuri was at Columbia in those early days before World War II. I guess he was at Columbia even during the war, on the uranium project. Who else? And Louis Hammett was another good friend of mine at Columbia. At Princeton, I was a good friend of Eyring when he was there, while he was there. Before I went back to Utah.
Did you know Hugh Taylor?
Huh?
Hugh Taylor,
I knew, not as well as Eyring. Mm-hmm. I knew the brothers that were there, Smythe, the one in physics and the one in chemistry. Mm-hmm. The one in chemistry was a great dipole moment investigator.
Right.
I knew the fellow was ran analytical chemistry at Princeton for so many years.
Furman.
Furman, yeah. I knew the Penn crowd quite well, by the way. You know, there's a general chemistry by McCutcheon, Seltz, and Warner.
Right.
Tom McCutcheon. I knew Tom very well. I knew, of course, you have, what's his name, organic chemist, one-armed organic chemist.
Well, Charles Price.
Charlie Price.
He was very active, actually, in the center. Yeah. Did you know Claude Dyscher by any chance?
No, I don't.
You know Claude?
Let's see, who else at Penn? Of course, Harry Sells came. I knew Harnard when he was at Penn. And later went to Yale. Of course, Harry Seltz came from there, PhD from there. The old head of our department was a doctorate from Penn, Joseph James, but I expect he's from back from Edgar Faw's days.
He may have been a Smith student, right?
I expect he was. All right, now, when I got going on this we'll talk about Scatcherd, and this applies to, in a different way, to Jack Kirkwood, too. Also, another guy that was involved somewhat is Kilpatrick, who was at Penn and went to Illinois Tech.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Martin and his wife, Mary, we used to say that Mary made him and Martin shot him. When I did this first job on the effect of dielectric constant and ionic strength on activation energies, Lemaire in this country and Marlon Hughes at Oxford had been assuming that you could make treat activation energies in solution reactions the same way you did gas reactions. That is, just get it from a variation of the rate constant with temperature.
Mm-hmm.
We found that of course, solution case, and out of that you get, if you look at activation energies that way, then in solution reactions you have a variation of activation energy with temperature. And out of this, Vic Lemaire gets a very fancy idea that there's an entropy of activation, just like there is for total energy. And he developed quite a fancy idea of calculating activation entropies. Well, we found that all he was getting was another effect on rate constants other than temperature, and that is a change in dielectric constant of the medium as you change the temperature. The dielectric constant decreases, you see. And so we claimed that if you wanted something to compare with gas activation energies, you should clear out everything except the effect of temperature on solution reactions. Well, one of these papers, I had on the New York ACS meeting program, and had already submitted it to the journal for publication. Well, out of a clear sky, and I never knew George Scatcherd before, mm-hmm. George writes me a letter. Dear Dr. Warner, I know it isn't the usual thing for reviewers of papers to do, to reveal themselves to the author, but you have a paper on the New York meeting schedule that I have received as for review for the journal. And I want to tell you, Dr. Warner, that you're not taking to the New York meeting a bunch of violets, you're taking a bombshell. And he said, but I want you to know that I'll be in the front row to defend you. That started the Scatcherd Warner friendship. Uh-huh. He came to speak about my work when I got the Pittsburgh Award of the ACS and so on.
Yeah, yeah. And a very influential figure in all of physical chemistry, writing and in corresponding and the like. Very interesting. So you would really say that during the 30s there was a pretty, in a way, kind of an informal but a tight group of physical chemists that were working on various problems and writing to each other and seeing each other at the meetings and the like, and trading students and everything. One thing I've heard, and this is actually from the side of the organic chemists, but I've heard, of course, organic chemists talking about their hostility to physical chemists within departments. Now, not on the on a national level, but this is at a department level.
Oh, I think there's a lot of feuding of that sort, but there never was any at Carnegie Tech.
But never at your institution.
No, there was never any. And we never let things get to the state where they were almost like different departments within a department. No. You know, there are a hell of a lot of places where the organic chemistry doctorates never take a course in physical chemistry. They don't know anything about thermodynamics. They don't know anything about gas kinetics, really.
Yeah, see, there's a lot of, sometimes there's a lot of resentment by organic chemists who feel that the physical chemists don't have to teach as much in the department, but get equal treatment and are also...
I don't know. I'd be greatly surprised if that were true.
Okay, well, this is one case that I can think of, but it was more just a general question to ask you. But at Carnegie, this was not the case at all.
there was a sensible sort of look at what all a guy was doing. If you had a lot of graduate students, you weren't asked to teach as many undergraduate courses. Mm-hmm. You weren't asked to teach as many hours a week. We more or less counted every doctorate and every master's student that worked with someone as part of his teaching load, you see. But this applied all across the department, and people in the department that had nothing to do with. Didn't teach a graduate course, and then, well, graduate courses were evaluated at 1.5 times or twice the value of an undergraduate course too. But a member of the faculty that of the old guard that never had graduate students, never taught graduate courses, well, he taught, what, 12 hours a week.
Now, during the 30s, as you were getting your research program going at Carnegie, did you have a lot of visiting speakers come in through Pittsburgh, the Paulings, and did these people ever make appearances at Carnegie Tech? And
oh, quite a few, graduate students? Yeah.
Any memorable, think of any speaker that was very memorable during the period, or that either influenced you or influenced maybe some of the other faculty members or students?
I don't remember anything that was startling. We used to, let's see, we had Charlie Krause, we had DeBye when he was at Cornell, we did have Warren Williams from Wisconsin. I guess we had Daniels. I think we had Daniels one time. I'm trying to think. We never had Scatcherd as a visiting lecturer. Never had Harnett. Although Harry Sells kept in touch with Harnett, I think, all his life. Harry, by the way, died much too young. Hell, he died when he was only 55 years old.
Mm-hmm. That's very young. Okay, I think we have a pretty good view of chemistry in the 30s. What I was going to ask you next is shifting gears, and it is to World War II. And
I tell you what happened up until World War II at Carnegie Tech could, with enough support and enough energy, and it takes a hell of a lot of energy and interest and enthusiasm to get a place going. Things like I mentioned before, Seltz and I ran a graduate seminar, met on Saturday morning. Now, where in the hell will you get faculty to come out Saturday morning for, in most big universities?
Not today.
Yeah, you don't. Where in the hell do you get a professor to, like McKinney did and like I did? I bundled up my faculty, went up to Ann Arbor to study theoretical physics for a summer at my own expense. Where in the hell do you find that anymore? They want a big grant.
Well, there's not as much. I think in some ways there's, as far as people don't take initiative as much as they, there's too many things that I think can diffuse a person's goal, I think.
Or at our Saturday morning seminar is another thing that we had a sort of an enthusiastic spirit among the graduate students and the young Turk faculty that you don't find many places. We would all go, the whole seminar would go either down to Oakland to Talbert's, or then later after it closed to Foo's, a German restaurant up on Mount Washington, for lunch. And we'd sit there, have lunch, and drink beer. And
after the seminar was over.
After the seminar was over, yeah.
But it makes for a great department.
That's right.
That makes for a great department. I was going to ask you, this goes back to you, what did the old-timers think of the young Turks?
Well, some of them resented it. Some of them recognized the facts of life. One of them was Tom Alexander, who was a Penn PhD, W&J undergraduate. Tom Alexander was graceful about it. He didn't know any more modern chemistry than he did when he finished his doctorate, I don't think. He could throw the best cocktail party of anybody in the apartment. Mm-hmm. Was a great guy with the ladies. I don't think he ever published a paper after his doctor. I don't even know what his doctor's thesis was. He was professor of inorganic chemistry. He did know, he had learned some about the transition metal complexes, all winter coordination compounds. He didn't know. He knew a fair amount of descriptive inorganic chemistry, but he didn't know. He knew hardly any mathematics. He couldn't integrate dx over x.
Descriptive chemistry that was then, really it was at Carnegie after you got to the really descriptive chemistry was in by and large replaced by a chemistry based on physics and mathematics, much more quantitative and exact.
That's right.
And that all took place really before World War II under your leadership and with Harry.
See, by that time we also had, in addition to Seltz and myself, we had McKinney and Fugazi as well-trained young Turks. Then it was after we had bad luck with two young organic chemists we hired in those days. That's when Doc James was still. One of them was hired before I was head of the chemistry department. I became head of the chemistry in 1938, and I hired a Bartlett PhD named Jones. He wasn't my choice. My choice was Saul Winstein.
Went to UCLA.
Who went to UCLA. He would have come to Carnegie Tech, but my damn dean, Webb Jones, dean of engineering and science, was really anti-Jewish, you know. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want me to hire Saul. Actually, Saul and I had a good bit of correspondence after he went to UCLA because I started doing kinetics on some reactions that he was very interested in, the epoxy reactions, you know. Chlorohydrine to ethylene oxide and a whole series of those things. That was the area after the war of kinetics that my students started working in. And a lot of interesting things.
That is very interesting. A very interesting view of the university as it's changing a great deal, and it's the kind of things that are hanging on from the old days.
And I might say Joseph Heide James was anti-Jewish too. Mm-hmm. The whole university was pretty damn anti-Jewish when I first came in, but it was because they were preparing people primarily for industry, and industry is revised. Hell, DuPont or GE wouldn't hire a Jew, chemist or an engineer or scientist.
Well, you know, Tischler only got one job offer in 1936.
Oh, there you are, you see.
And he was, this guy Melvin Newman had no jobs for about a year and a half. He was hanging on, just waiting for somebody to take him. Pretty good chemists, too. They were not,
That's right. Tischler was not out of the ordinary.
But it was only because George Merck Jr. saw something in Tischler that he liked. Otherwise, he would have never been hired.
I think it was because they found placing Jewish students was difficult. But it changed rapidly. It really changed rapidly. Of course, as soon as I became head of the chemistry department, we made no distinction. We started hiring independently. And I would have hired, except as I say, my dean kept me from hiring Saul Winstein.
Very interesting. What could have been in terms of physical organic at Carnegie?
Jones was supposed to do that, but Jones had a lousy disposition. He couldn't get along with anybody. And so we didn't encourage him to stay on. He went to industry somewhere. I don't know whatever happened to him.
Very interesting.
He was a kind that would park any damn place that was restricted, you know.
To start a fight almost?
He was nasty as hell to any security guard that would call him on it, you know. And it'd be the same way with students and with the other faculty.
Yes, there are types of people just like that too.
Yeah. And they're around today. Just ornery.
They're around today too.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, we get to World War II, and you work at the Manhattan Project.
That's right.
I don't know anything about that in terms of what you did.
Well, I might say that before, after Daddy came and we started going places, I was made chairman of what they called, didn't have a graduate dean then. They had a committee on graduate degrees, and I was made chairman of that. And we got a new deal in physics. We brought Fred Seitz here. He'd been on the physics faculty at Penn, you remember, mm-hmm. Princeton PhD, and one of our great guys in solid state physics. And he came, they brought him here from Penn as head of physics. And with that, Stern's separate laboratory of molecular physics became part of the physics department, you see. In the meantime, in the metallurgy, the metals research lab became just a part of the Department of Metallurgy. And there's another young Turk, by the way, that was brought here from Bob Mayle, Robert Mayle.
M-E-H-L.
Same as my aunt, yes. One of my ancestors, but not related. He was a Franklin Marshall guy who did physical chemistry degree at Princeton. Then he was a national research fellow at Harvard. And then he went to work for the Naval Research Lab and was responsible for developing a method for finding defects in castings by gamma radiation scheme. And that attracted so much attention that he went from there to be associate director of research at Armco, and then Doherty brought him here as head of this metals research laboratory, and the next year made him head of metallurgy also, so it became all one, you see. Well, Bob Mayle built a very good department. He had the same ideas that Seltz and I had. We were all good friends. When the year that Doherty came here, Mayle attracted me to come down on his faculty, and I went down there to start a program on a research on physical chemistry of metallurgical reactions. That was the right time. Doherty came here. 2 years later, they separated chemistry and chemical engineering into two departments. And Doherty said, and we brought Warren McCabe, my suggestion here from Michigan, as head of chemical engineering. And Doherty, he came the same, a couple of years before Doherty did, with the understanding that we would make him head of chemical engineering. So it was all set as who would head chemical engineering when the separation came in 38. Here I was down in metallurgy. Doherty asked Jones, the dean of science and engineering, who's going to be head of chemistry. And Doherty knew all about my research. I told you about how he hung around my lab
during his visit.
Yeah, and we had, of course, been kept in touch with his ideas about education. And Webb didn't seem to know, Webb Jones. He said, "What in the hell did you let Jake Warner go down into metallurgy for if he needed a head of chemistry?" Well, Webb didn't quite understand what it was all about, but I was brought back in a hurry to be head of chemistry, you see.
And McCabe became then head of chemical
engineering. Yeah.
What was McCabe like? Do you have any?
He was a very pleasant fellow, Right. I think he was a good chemical engineer.
And built a good, a strong department as
well. Quite a good one. He left. He had a wife who was quite demanding on the money side, and I think she kept after him to take a better paying industrial job. And he did finally left Carnegie Tech and was vice president for research of Flint Coat Company. He made more money, but I don't know, he was unhappy. You know what he did? He finally went back to Brooklyn Polytech as dean of the faculty.
I didn't know that. No, yeah. I didn't know that. Because, you know, he's one of the great early chemical engineers in a way.
Oh, yeah.
With that textbook he had, Badger
and McCabe. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I forgot my name. He was there. He had brought in a number of good younger men. One from Wisconsin, who later became dean of engineering at Maryland, chemical engineer, and he brought a young one from University of Rochester. He brought Carl Monrad, who was a Michigan
Monrad,
M-O-N-R-A-D. Who was a Michigan PhD in chemical engineering and had gone to Standard of Indiana. Monrad became head of the department when McCabe left and was there until his retirement. Yes, Monrad built McCabe gave a big shot in the arm to chemical engineering. You see, old Doc James retired right at that time, at 38. That's what they had planned, to separate the two departments when Doc James retired. McCabe has retired down to Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know where what has happened to him. Mm-hmm. Or that, but of course, everyone recognizes his name as a very important figure. Very good.
Well,